5. Their heads were bent together in the dull green reflection of the viewers. They were in a small, converted, lead-lined storage room in the lowest level of the African mine site. Johnny was getting his first look at the fruits of earlier work. There were 10 days' worth of discs, and it was a considerable pile. Dunnell Dean had explained that he couldn't come earlier. There were lots of pilots graduating and needing their final checkout flights, and it would have been suspicious to leave America at a busy peak. He had also brought 14 new pilots to Africa, and Johnny and Stormalong could nurse them through their advanced combat here. They were good lads, Swedes and Germans. Care was going full blast training machine operators. Every tribe seemed to want a blade scraper and flatbeds for buses. Brown Limper was selling the tribe's equipment even from their own nearby mine sites, and they had to have operators. Ore carriers were busy lugging machinery over the globe, and they had to have pilots. Angus had come back with Dunnell Dean, for he was finding it too hard not to shoot Lars Thorensen on sight. There was also the matter of Page One. Johnny skimmed through the beginnings of Turl's reoccupancy. It was enough to know that that crucial hour after he had left had really been pay dirt. They'd planted 32 false bugs, and even feeders and recorders, and there was Turl, big as life, dumping them on his desk, convinced. When he saw that Turl was apparently using a mine radio to detect feeder channels to the recorders, he had a moment's qualm, but then he realized their main feeder was a ground wave. A false bottom to the cabinets. He hadn't suspected that, for they simply looked armored. And this huge, thick book he was bringing out, about 3 feet wide and 2 feet high and 7 inches thick, and on the thinnest paper he had ever seen. Thousands of pages. Each page was divided into about 40 vertical columns. Over at the left, the widest column gave the name of a system, and below it, the names of planets in that system. From left to right in the columns followed every movement of the system, such as its speed of travel and direction, precession, torque, and the weight and quality of the sun, or suns if double or treble. In the columns beside every planet of that system were noted that planet's own weight, rotation period, atmosphere, surface temperatures, races, city coordinates, relative mineral estimate by symbols, and value in galactic credits, and the location of its mine sites, if any. All speeds and directions of travel were based on the zero center of that universe and three-dimensional compass coordinates using the inevitable cyclonumeral 11 and parts of 11 and powers of 11. Turl had sat there day after day, turning pages of it, one by one, running a claw down one particular column. He had gone through the whole book. They had every page.
"Accept page one," said Dunnell Dean. "I don't understand several of these symbols, because they are so abbreviated. Look at how tiny these figures are. We reviewed it and found we didn't have page one. We figured that would be the symbol key code, and Turl knew it all so well that he never referred to it. But look at that last disc there."
Johnny was a bit dazzled. He had had no idea there were that many populated systems, much less planets. Thousands and thousands and thousands. It would take somebody a month or two just to count them. 16 universes. And these were only the ones the Cyclos had an interest in. This accumulated knowledge must have taken several millennia to compile. He looked very closely at the writing. He could swear it was Jinko. He came out of it a bit. "I don't understand some of these symbols," he said.
"That's what I'm trying to tell you. That was part of the delay. I didn't want to put you in the frying pan waiting for the key to the symbols, so we did the waiting. Look at the last disc."
Johnny did so. Turl had thrown the whole book down, and the ventilator had blown up the cover by accident, and there was page one, all the symbols listed and what they meant. "We've got all the positions and firing coordinates of 16 universes," said Johnny. Then he sobered. What was he looking for? Tyrrell had thrown the book down in disgust. That was plain. Johnny played the disc a little more. The sound on it, which was not of much use, was very colorful cyclo-cursing. For those whole 2 days, a blank piece of paper had been lying there with not a mark on it. Now Tyrrell almost ruined his pen as he wrote a figure on it. Johnny went back to an earlier disc and looked more critically at what column Tyrrell's claw was moving down. By the symbol at the top of it, the column was Transshipment Firing Times 2/at Cyclo. Johnny understood it. Tyrrell was trying to find an open period at Cyclo so that nothing he shipped would collide with something some other planet was shipping. Johnny recalled from his machine training days that the Cyclos never changed these tables for decades on end. Looking at the number of planets sending and receiving, the Cyclo platform must run constantly, day and night. He also had gotten the impression that one planet couldn't have two platforms operating, for it made interference. The nearest second platform for transshipment had to be about 50,000 miles away, and since the diameter of Cyclo was only about 25,000 miles, they only had one platform. So, if Tyrrell didn't want to collide with somebody else's ore arriving, or smelted metal going out to some buyers, or maybe military hardware, he had to be careful to find an open period. If one fired ore or machinery, one could be quick about it, but live personnel required a longer time period, or it shook them up. Tyrrell was taking no chances with his own neck. The figure he so disgustedly wrote, almost breaking his pen, was Day 92. He had been forced to choose a time more than 5 months from now. It was quite evident from the amount of Kerbango he then consumed that the thought of spending all that additional time on this accursed planet, as the Sonic recorded him saying, was upsetting. He had had to choose Earth's next scheduled semi-annual, and finally, by the next day, he had reconciled himself to it. Expecting the new disks would show the beginning calculations and circuits of a transshipment console, Johnny was amazed not to find it. Tyrrell had gone to another cabinet and opened up its back. Using both paws, he removed a package. It appeared to be a bit heavy. He opened up the wrappings and then got a big pair of tongs, big enough to lift a huge boulder. He screwed the gap down to about a quarter of an inch and reached into the package. The picture didn't show what he was lifting out at first. Then he dropped it, and it hit the floor. Tyrrell's curse was very sharp. He got down with the tongs and lifted a gray something about the size of a pea. For an instant, the spot on the floor showed. Johnny still framed it. The metal floor was dented deeply. Tyrrell managed to pick up the small object again with the tongs, a hard job because it had sunk in the floor. He lifted it back up to lay on the side of the table. Johnny did a very quick calculation. He knew how strong Tyrrell was within rough limits. The amount of effort when you subtracted those big tongs made that little pea-sized piece of metal weigh about 75 pounds at a wild guess. Johnny got busy. He called Angus and had him set up the mineral analyzer that should transfer traces from the disk and enlarge them. He went and got the trace code books. For the next 3 hours, they tried to find that trace. It wasn't there. The Cyclos didn't list it, or any composite trace of it, in any of their code books. They were dealing with a metal the Cyclos had but didn't list. Johnny tried to estimate by weight and volume and periodic tables what its atomic number was. The Earth tables were of no value at all. This thing would be way off the bottom of them. He looked over the Cyclo periodic tables, so different from the old Earth ones. There were a lot of elements that would have atomic numbers as high as this one, maybe even higher, but if they didn't have its name, Johnny suddenly realized it probably wasn't on the Cyclo table either, if it wasn't in their analysis books. "I wish I were some good at this," said Johnny. "But, laddie," said Donald Dean, "I think you're a plain wizard."
I fell in the mineshaft about 2 hours ago and haven't been heard of since.
Johnny said, These are atomic numbers. An atom is supposedly composed of a core with energy particles in it, some of them positively charged, some of them not charged at all. The number of positively charged particles is what they call the atomic number, and these particles, together with the uncharged particles, make up the atomic weight. Also, around the core are negatively charged particles that circle the core in what they call rings or shells. But they're not. They are more like envelopes. Anyway, the core and the negatively charged particles around it gives one the different elements. That's about all there is to a periodic table, to oversimplify it. But ancient man here on Earth constructed his tables on oxygen and carbon, I think because those were important to him. He is a carbon-oxygen engine. But a cyclo has a different metabolism and burns different elements for energy, so the cyclo table is different. Also, cyclos had a lot more universes to work in, and they had metals and gases Earth's old scientists never heard of. The ancients here on Earth also omitted distances of spacing between the core and the ring, and between ring and ring, as a variable. So they didn't realize that one core and one ring at one spacing could be quite something else when the spacing changed. Got it?
Laddie, said Dunaldine, that thump you just heard was me hitting the bottom of the shaft.
Don't be lonely down there, said Johnny. I hit it every time I get tangled up in this. But the point is, what is he up to? This is not a transshipment rig component. They looked at other disks. Turl considered metal like a man would consider paper, easily worked with. He had bullied Lars into getting him a sheet of a beryllium alloy, and it almost hurt their ears when Lars couldn't find it anywhere in the compound, and Turl told him the blank stuff was what they used for panel metal in vehicles, and to go down to the blank garages and get into that blank zitz repair supplies and get him a blank sheet of the stuff. Lars trotted back shortly, his panting clear on the disc sonic, bringing a sheet of beryllium alloy that rumbled as it waved about. Turl kicked him out and locked the door. They did a quick analysis of the metal, and even Dunaldine had no trouble with the traces. It was beryllium, copper, and nickel, sort of rough, for it had not been polished. On the disc, Turl took some shears and cut expertly. Then he folded some edges. He annealed the edges shut by molecular bind. Then he had a top which fit very well. He put a little knob on the top for lifting it. Then he cut a hole in the bottom of the box and made a screw-in access plate. He had begun to laugh, so it was easy to divine that this was something quite nasty. It was a pretty box when he finished. He polished it up and buffed it, and it looked like jewelry, a gold color. Pretty. It was hexagonal, each one of the six sides and corners geometrically precise. Quite a work of art. The top came off easily. The bottom hole access plate was left unscrewed. It was about a foot across and about 5 inches high. The next day, he went to work on the inside. He made some very precisely hinged rods, quite intricate. He fitted them into the box and tested them. There was a hinged rod in each of the six corners, and it was fastened to the lid. When you raised the lid, these rods pushed sockets, empty as yet, to the center of the box. He tested it several times and laughed louder as he gazed up into it from the access hole in the bottom. The cover came off very smoothly. Each of the six rods pushed an empty socket to the center. Then he chased Lars all around, finding different common substances, and eventually he had three different metals and three different nonmetals in a pile. They were just ordinary elements, the analyzer said. Iron, silicon, sodium, magnesium, sulfur, and phosphorus. Why? To what end? Johnny tore through some books. Sodium, magnesium, sulfur, and phosphorus had one thing in common. They were of use, one way or another, in explosives. Knowing Turl, that was the first thing Johnny looked up. But this combination he didn't think would explode, because there they lay, right on the table in an earlier frame, right together, and they didn't explode. Iron and silicon? It seemed that they were very common indeed in the composition of the Earth's crust and core. He looked at a later frame, quite apprehensive. What if Turl made something and then hid it outside and they couldn't find it? What was this devil up to? Ah, Turl might have jumbled up the six elements, but the strange pea-sized mineral had vanished. Johnny backtracked on the disk. Turl had taken the heavy bit of strange metal and measured it, and then had wrapped it all up and put it back in the false cabinet. The place where it had lain now had a dent. He made a braced basket to hold the pea in the center. But he didn't put it in, for it was now back in the cabinet. Then he put the six common elements, each one, in the slots on the rods. When one opened the lid, the rods pushed them all into the center. They would go into contact with each other and with the pea. Johnny knew something about radiation and elements after their early battle. He knew that all you had to do was stimulate the atoms to get a chain reaction going. But Turl was not working with uranium radiation. He couldn't. Not with the overstimulation radiation gave to breathe gas. So that pea thing must be some higher order of stimulation. Knowing Turl, it would be deadly. He was sure that when that heavy, heavy, pea-sized piece of metal was in the center, and somebody opened the lid and all those metals pushed together and against it, something ghastly was going to happen. Turl locked the pretty box away, cleaned things up, and opened a mathematics text entitled Force Equations, which had nothing to do with teleportation. What was he up to now? And that was as far as the disks went. Their own clock had moved up to noon, as they had gone non-stop, no sleep, no food.
"Now I know who made Satan," said Donaldine. "His name was Turtle.